Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau from Compassionate Cooks, which I founded to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. Hi, everybody. It's great to be here with you today, so soon. I'd like to thank today's sponsor first and foremost. The sponsor for today's episode is Linda Coxis, whose wonderful story about her own transformation to veganism is on the Joyful Vegan blog, which you can access through CompassionateCooks.com. I asked Linda to contribute her story of becoming vegan to the Joyful Vegan website, and I'd love to just read a few excerpts here before we get started. I love that she's able to remember so many of the little seeds that were planted before full consciousness set in. Here's a bit of her story. When I was a child, I loved animals, or so I thought, for while I really felt a kinship and a great deal of affection for all animals, I hadn't made the connection between their lives and who it was I was sacrificing and eating every day. When I was growing up, we always had pets. Birds, fish, hamsters, rats, hermit crabs, dogs, and many cats. I was an only child, and our pets were really a part of our small family of two humans. I wanted to be a zoologist or an oceanographer when I grew up. I empathized with worms that I would see washed up on the sidewalk after a rain on my way home from school, and I would stop to move them back into the soil when I saw them. I was really into animals. When I was 11, I went to a friend's house for dinner. They were preparing lobster, which I never had before. I watched in horror as my friend's father put a live lobster into a huge pot of boiling water. They acted like this was totally normal, but I'd never seen anything like it. Then, a couple of long minutes later, the poor lobster threw the lid of the pot onto the floor in a valiant attempt to save his life. One claw was poking out, reaching. He was still alive in there somehow. The father slammed the lid back on and walked away. I didn't have any lobster that day. After I moved from my hometown of Corte Madera, California, to San Francisco, I was a waitress on Haight Street for many years. I didn't have to learn to cook because I was allowed to order anything I wanted from the menu while I worked. My choices were typically Eggs Benedict, cheeseburgers, pepperoni pizza, salads with turkey, eggs, and 1,000 Island dressing, and such not a healthy diet at all. When I cooked for myself, it was usually boxed macaroni and cheese and bologna sandwiches, maybe a broiled salmon steak if I was feeling quote-unquote fancy. Another time, one of the cooks kindly read me the ingredients on the box of ground beef that I was eating as burgers. I will never forget the first two ingredients: beef hearts, partially defatted beef fatty tissue. Even as a meat eater, this really, really made me sick. I stopped eating burgers there right away, although I still ate them elsewhere, and I consumed all kinds of other animals' bodies without giving them any consideration whatsoever. It was incidents like these that started giving me clues that the way I was eating really wasn't in conjunction with my true desires and feelings. The first time I heard the word vegan, it was when a customer asked me if a particular dish on the menu was vegan. I had no idea what he was talking about, and I thought it might be some kind of cult diet or something. I stared back at him blankly as I tried to figure out what that weird word he said meant. That seems so funny to me now, the fact that I didn't even know what veganism was, and now it's such a huge part of my life. One day when I was 22 years old, I came home from an exhausting day of waiting tables and lay down on the couch to watch some TV. I turned on PBS because I love documentaries and they show them often. What I saw then changed my life forever. It is such a great coincidence that I didn't do something more useful than watch TV that day. They were showing Diet for a New America, the incredible documentary by John Robbins about how what we eat affects ourselves, animals, and the planet. I watched, amazed, as everything I had been taught about animal products in my life and diet was expertly dismantled by this kind, compassionate person. I sat, rapt, with tears in my eyes, as he described and showed footage of the conditions on factory farms and the endless amounts of unnecessary suffering that animals are forced to endure to turn them into products that are so unhealthy for our bodies and our environment. You can read Linda's full story on the blog, and I really encourage you to do so. There's nothing remarkable about Linda's process. It's one that I think we can all identify with. It's just full of such honesty and truth, and I highly encourage you to check it out. So thank you, Linda, so much for your support and your courage and your contributions on behalf of the animals. So welcome to another episode where I share with you a narrative written by someone else other than me, narratives that expand upon topics we've covered or that help us deepen our understanding of and our relationship to non-human animals. The essay I want to read today is very, very special. It was written by Joanna Lucas, who writes the blog for Peaceful Prairie Sanctuary. I cannot say enough about this organization and the people who run it, or about Joanna and her writing. Her writing will speak for itself. She is an incredibly gifted writer, and she expresses the suffering and exploitation of animals with sensitive, thoughtful language and captures the personalities of individually rescued animals in such beautiful ways. I encourage you to visit www.peacefulprairie.org, support the organization, and read Joanna's blog. This essay is called Portrait of Marcy, a Beautiful Soul. When Marcy arrived at Peaceful Prairie Sanctuary, she had already lost everything: her freedom, her community, her family, her youth, every baby she had ever had, everyone she had ever loved, everyone she had ever trusted, everything that was familiar. She arrived in this new world with nothing, except for the brief time before she went blind, the ability to see with her own eyes this improbable land of open vistas, big sky, free inhabitants, and people who wished them life, this free state that billions of captive animals never experience, but that all yearn for in their living cells to their last breath, and perhaps to believe it. Like all farmed animals, Marcy was defined not by what was there, but by what was missing, the visible and invisible amputations of a lifetime of slavery, mutilated body, broken spirit, wounded soul, unrealized life, unrealized potential, capacity for pain filled to the brim, capacity for joy left utterly empty. In her last years of confinement on a small family farm, where she repeatedly watched her babies being killed, so much had already been taken from her that by the time she was rescued and brought to a place where she could finally begin her life, there wasn't much left to build a life on. Her first year at the sanctuary, when she could still see, she fled from anyone who looked like her abusers, any human being around. And for the rest of her life, she avoided anyone who looked like herself, every ewe, ram, or lamb around. She hid her big, beautiful, billowy self among the goats, dawdling along conspicuously ovine amid the gust of quick, slender, angular, light-footed goats, secure in the belief that she was well camouflaged among these creatures who looked, walked, sounded, and acted nothing like herself. She traveled with them, foraged with them, camped with them, ignored the fact that to everybody's mind but her own, they were a poor fit for her. Too fast, too rowdy, too mischievous, too bold, too unpredictable for her, and forgave them their many trespasses, such as the time when they left her behind, way out in the field, ignored her calls for location, and went home without her. But for reasons she well understood, she remained unflinchingly loyal to them for the rest of her life. Whatever Marcy saw in the goats, learned from them, received from them, was clearly something she needed. We joked that she thought she was a goat, but more likely the opposite was true. What seemed to draw her to the goats was not the imagined similarity, but the perceived difference. She seemed to want to be someone completely unlike herself, a different animal altogether, someone totally unlike the powerless victim she had been all her life. So she joined the goats and shared her deepest moments of peace with them. You could see her and them resting in the sun in a trance-like, almost solemn state, as though listening together to a magnificent symphony, and in fact doing just that, hearing the leaves of spring, the rustle of insect wings, the wind darting over the face of the pond, and savoring the scent of the wind itself, feeling beauty, being absorbed by beauty, not what we call beauty, not the pretty things, but what is beauty, the knowledge inherent in all things, in a stone, a leaf, a blade of grass, the profound experience of harmony and connection with something deeply good and deeply loving, the felt wisdom of being alive in a world of scent and taste and sound and touch, with nerve endings responding in delight to every breeze, every faint happening, every detail in the world's face of dazzling color and rolling movement and depth. Those moments, full of feeling, brimming with exquisite awareness, giddy with the life within, she shared with the goats. But in her moments of sorrow, she was alone. And she had moments of wrenching, inconsolable sorrow, some triggered by invisible quakes, others triggered by events that even we could see and understand, such as the times when the smell of lambs born, torn from their mothers and slaughtered on neighboring farms filled the air and stirred her old pain, a pain that didn't lessen with time, but seemed to grow new thorns every spring. Those were the times when she wandered off most often, becoming separated from her adopted herd, getting lost, and in her blindness, unable to find her way home. Because human presence terrified her, the only way we could guide her back home was to call out to the goats, hoping that they would respond loud enough for Marcy to hear and follow the sound trail back to the herd. The goats she trusted, but humans evoked nothing but horror. The horror she remembered and the horror she anticipated at our hands. We understood her apprehension and went out of our way to not intrude in her safe zone. What we didn't understand then, and still don't fully understand today, is why she chose to narrow the physical and emotional distance between us and got 1 inch closer to us every day until there was no distance left at all, until our noses touched, literally. She got nothing extra from our proximity, nothing that she didn't already get in abundance while avoiding us. Food, shelter, friends, treats were all readily available to her whether or not she accepted us. So why did she decide to trust us when throughout her life humans had done unspeakably cruel things to her for a taste of her baby's flesh, for a handful of wool, for a patch of lamb skin? Why did she suffer with us when she could just as easily ignore us? It's hard to say, but the fact is, she not only accepted us, she sought us out. If, in her estimation, either of us had been inside the house too long, she knocked on the door with her hoof and summoned us out. We came out every time, treat in hand, because that's what we assumed she wanted. And for the rest of her life, she drilled us out onto the porch this way several times a day. Then, her last year with us, she extended her vigils into the night. She started to wait up for Chris, stationing herself on the porch, waiting quietly, patiently, as long as it took, until midnight, until the following morning, until Chris was safely home from work. She waited without complaining, without asking for treats or attention or companionship or any of the pleasures that we thought motivated her to knock on the door every afternoon. She just anchored herself at the front door and kept her late night solitary vigils away from the security of the herd, away from shelter, under the open sky, and nothing could get her to move. Neither Bluto's boisterous barking, nor the alarming distance from her goats, nor the rain, nor the thunder, nor the snow. She stood there, like a good mother, wedged between earth and sky, with a mixture of courage, trust, expectation, hope, and resignation, her massive body firmly anchored between the big, bad, perilous world and her self-appointed charge. And she didn't budge until Chris was safely home. Only then would she finally get up, leave the porch, and amble to her barn for the night, with the treat of solid proof that both Chris and Michelle were alive and well. It wasn't a plan. It was a far simpler, far wiser, far more deeply felt truth than that. Marcy wished us life. She wanted for those she loved to continue to live, and she was determined that for once in her life they would. She demanded treat-in-hand proof of our wellness several times a day, and she guarded the porch at night until she was sure that both of her humans were alive and well. It was simple enough. Most of us can understand love. What most of us may never understand is how Marcy could forgive her abusers so completely that she was able to love their kin. On behalf of the billions of animals who are right now at the mercy of humans, and on behalf of the billions of humans who have the capacity to show mercy, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.